Morning. May it please the court. My name is Deborah Ellis, and I represent Robert Ford. Robert Ford appeals from the denial of his petition or motion for relief filed under Section 2255 of Title 28. Following his trial in the Southern District of South Dakota, he was found not guilty of sexual abuse, but guilty of kidnapping. His case was before this court on direct appeal, and in an opinion authored by Judge Smith in 2013, his conviction of kidnapping was affirmed. And the issue on the direct appeal was whether his conviction of kidnapping for restraining Ms. Weston to prevent her from reporting a sexual abuse could be sustained based on his acquittal of the sexual abuse. And this court held that there was no conviction necessary of sexual abuse to sustain the kidnapping because he could have held her on the belief that she intended to report abuse even if it had not occurred. In his 2255 motion, he has alleged ineffective assistance of counsel for failing to investigate and uncover evidence that would have served to undermine Ms. Weston's credibility, showing her bias, her interest, her unreliability, and lack of credibility on the charges. The district court focused on the prejudice prong of Strickland and thus did not order a hearing. The judge concluded that there was no prejudice because even
after... The magistrate judge went quite a bit further.
Did. That's
and
true.
The magistrate judge's findings and conclusions were summarily adopted in full.
Correct.
So we have to give some level of deference or consideration to the magistrate judge's peek, if you will, into deliberate and the performance prong.
I agree. I would like to focus first on the prejudice.
I think that's right, but I assume you're going to... Are you going to start with your hearing argument? Because I want to talk about that, but go. I don't want to...
Well, I would agree that there's... Well, if there's a finding that there's just no possibility of prejudice, then, of course, I suppose the court doesn't have to order an evidentiary hearing.
Well, what hearing was requested?
A hearing on the issue of ineffective assistance.
What would that hearing have? What would have been the evidentiary component of that hearing?
It would have been an opportunity to call trial counsel to present trial counsel with evidence that he did not obtain, and he admits in his own affidavit that he.
We have a 7-page, single spaced affidavit from the trial attorney.
Right, which says, "I wish I had more."
You see, I'm terribly confused as to whether you contemplated, and I don't know whether you were the how whether you're new for the appeal or not, but in any event, was this a failure to call impeaching witnesses at trial, or a failure to use judicial and other documentary records to cross-examine Ms. Weston?
Both.
If it's the witnesses, then I would expect, as the trial court and Eighth Circuit precedent, that the trial court said, who do you want to call and why? And then and when I get an answer to that, I'll tell you whether you get a hearing. I don't see that in the briefing here or in the appendix.
Okay, well, I believe that. I have shown that there is a wealth of information that the trial counsel did not have, and trial counsel said that would have been helpful, like a false allegation of kidnapping. That's
if you had said the ineffective assistance was not calling Gunderson and everyone else who lay behind the 10 or 12 run-ins, if you will, that Ms. Weston clearly had with law enforcement or tribal authorities. Trial court wait a minute. That would have been so many mini trials that no trial court would ever have tolerated that.
Well,
so it seems to me that we are lacking here, and I think it was Mr. Ford's attorney's burden to present to the district court exactly what factual inquiry was needed for a hearing, and absent, and why we have a pretty good record of what your investigator found, what counsel's investigator found, and what counsel thought of the process.
Well, I think absent the finding that there's no prejudice, then the next step would have been, okay, I'll set this for a hearing. Tell me who you're going to call or exchange witnesses. In the past, I've done many of these.
You have to go there to get, I mean, it's both prongs are affected.
And when you allege ineffective assistance of counsel, I expect that I will call defense counsel. And if I don't call defense counsel and I just call an expert to say this was totally ineffective because defense counsel didn't use this, then the prosecution calls the defense counsel to say, well, maybe if I had known that, I wouldn't have used it. So I wouldn't expect that I have to say I'm going to call defense counsel, because that kind of goes part and parcel with the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
You got a seven-page, one-line, single-spaced affidavit from defense counsel, who obviously would prefer not to have his practice interrupted by this.
Of course, and it's self-serving.
So now the district judge has a discretionary decision to make.
But
tell me why the affidavit doesn't give me enough to proceed.
Because there's no cross-examination that went with that affidavit. And so it is, he's trying to preserve himself, of course.
Well, then the trial court says, okay, depose him.
Fine. Then I have him under oath and with cross-examination and showing him.
That deposition would be critical to prejudice as well as performance.
But I'm cut off at the prejudice. Once the court just says, seems it's kind of convenient to say, doesn't really matter, whatever you say, I find these three other pieces of evidence so strong.
On what submission from counsel for Mr. Ford, for petitioner, mm-hmm. was the no prejudice decision made? And if it was made on what you considered an inadequate record, there should have been a motion for reconsideration.
No, I didn't. The trial court, I believe, made its decision on no prejudice just based on the trial record. And interestingly, yes, the magistrate went through, combed through the file, and determined, the magistrate had not sat as the presiding court, and decided that there's three little pieces of evidence were so strong that it didn't really matter.
Well, counsel, those other pieces of evidence were evidence that didn't depend upon the credibility of the victim.
Right, but
so however much impeachment you put in to discredit the victim, there were other persons present who testified about their impressions of what had happened that were consistent with the statement that she was held there against her will.
Actually, I don't believe that they were consistent. I mean, if you're talking about Mr. Sherman and Ms. Redhart, who said that one said he heard a commotion at some point, and the other woman said she heard a sound like a shattered sole. Well, a commotion, was it furniture that was moving? Was it a bed leg that scraped? There's nothing to suggest that whatever commotion or shattered soul, was there a groan? Was there a guttural sound?
Retrying the case.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that.
That all should have been, and presumably was, the subject of the direct and cross of the two people, two witnesses outside the room.
I think that the point is, if the trial court is going to look at three pieces of evidence that the trial court said this was so convincing that nothing you say about what trial counsel did or did not do, this conviction on kidnapping would stand based upon bruises. When she's asked, how did you get those? She said, I have no idea. And based upon two people saying they heard a commotion of no particular designation, these are issues that the district court pulled out on its own.
But does any of the proposed evidence that was missed affect the credibility of the two outside witnesses as opposed to the victim?
No. It goes to Ms. Weston. And so I believe that this court would have to find, and at no point has anyone said this evidence was so strong or so overwhelming that there's no way on this earth that this kidnapping conviction could not have been sustained. So aside from the commotion and the bruises, which she has no idea how she got them, then there's the issue of he made a call to her mother. And the magistrate relies on the fact that the prosecutor argued, well, why would he call her mother if she was free to leave? But, I mean, that's just kind of all, you know, various interpretations. But he called her mother because he found her in a state that he says was either, as a mental breakdown, she's having a fit, or an attack, is what he told her cousin. So it defies logic that he was going to call her mother after he had attacked her and held her against her will. I'd also note that the district court does sort of a circular argument, rationale for saying that there's no need for a hearing because this other evidence is apparently so strong. But the district court said that the commotion was heard as evidence of confinement while he was detaining Weston. Well, that's circular. That's saying he was detaining and then there was the commotion. There's a commotion that was heard. It wasn't connected up in any way, shape, or form to any confinement. Similarly, the district court found phone calls were made while he was detaining Weston. And again, the court then is making a finding of detention and then saying the phone call supports it. And in fact, both the magistrate and the district court seem to say or want to imply that bruise, commotion, and his phone call to her mother were so strong that any other deficiencies by counsel or any other problems with the case would not have mattered.
Well, particularly the problems with her credibility, because the jury already took that into account in acquitting him of the sexual assault.
Not necessarily, because there was medical evidence to contradict that. And defense counsel, as the court noted, brought out some inconsistencies between what she told the police and what she testified to, and then brought in medical evidence. And the medical evidence was probably more what impeached her claim of a sexual assault. Unless the court finds that this other evidence was so strong that there's no other way that he absolutely would have been convicted of kidnapping, then I think that it's incumbent upon the court to remand for the
additional evidence was all to attack her credibility and character.
Right, and if so, if you think...
And then what the district court is talking about is objective evidence consistent with guilt. So I think you're overstating.
I'd suggest that objective evidence is weak and it is not consistent with guilt.
But that doesn't establish that more bad character evidence, and there was obviously much of anyway, that more would have made a difference.
Well, I think a key one would be she made a false allegation of kidnapping against her ex-husband and wife. Obviously, she probably was mad because...
There we would have had to have a mini-trial, wouldn't we?
No, I don't believe so, because that would have been...
How do you know it's false? Well, you just said false. That's, of course, the critical...
Only if she denies it. So she could be asked on cross-examination, you're here testifying in this trial, sexual abuse and kidnapping, alleging that you've been confined. You have claimed in the past that other people have done it. You have made claims of kidnapping in the past. Yes or no? You claim that your ex-husband kidnapped your children. She could say yes, and you claim that because you were mad and you lost custody of them, and that wasn't true. He was awarded the custody, and you claimed it was kidnapping.
What's your best case for impeachment alone? Better or different impeachment alone establishing a habeas claim? a 2255 prejudice claim?
That trial counsel did not have all the information.
No, I said your best authority.
My what?
Supreme Court or Eighth Circuit.
Pardon me?
The Supreme Court, what's your best case for the proposition that a little bit better or a lot better impeachment is sufficient to establish a 2255
I think in Strickland, I think in Strickland it talks about the failing to investigate.
How many times have I read it?
Right, but...
The facts in Strickland.
Okay.
I want factually relevant cases. Okay. Lawyers never give us that, and
I'm
it's
sorry.
Very frustrating.
I'm sorry. Then I can't cite to you one right off the bat. Okay. Thank you. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Ellis. Mr. Kohler, I think you could cut right to the chase if you'll highlight for us what's in this record that would support upholding the conviction, even if the victim's credibility is eliminated entirely.
Well, thank you, Your Honor. I'm Kevin Colliner from South Dakota here arguing for the government. I'm here to say that we agree with the district court entirely in this case. And both the district court and the magistrate detailed a variety of pieces of evidence here that were distinct from Ms. Weston's
outline it.
First of all, good appellate advocacy is to answer the judge's question when it's asked, even if it interferes with your idea of a logical presentation.
I'm sorry. Perhaps I misunderstood the question because I...
Well, my question was, let's get right to it. What do you have if we just assumed the victim couldn't be believed at all? What is left of a case against the defendant that he had committed the crime of conviction?
And what I was about to say was to talk about the evidence of the kidnapping aside from Ms. Weston's testimony.
Outline it for us.
And that includes, there are four separate witnesses, including Ms. Weston, but it's Mr. Sherman, Ms. Red Earth, and then also the physician's assistant, Mrs. Deutscher, who talked about the bruises. And so we have the two witnesses who were there with Ms. Weston the night before, who testified at trial and who also told the FBI agent that the bruising that they saw on her the following morning was not present the night before. We have the physician's assistant who testified, not only Ms. Weston reported to her that the bruising was new, but that in her experience, based upon her medical experience, the bruising appeared to her to be new. The jury also saw photographs of the bruising. And in the closing argument, the prosecutor talked about how they could use their common sense and their own experiences to judge from the photos that the redness and the darkness of the bruising made those bruises appear to be new bruises. We also have testimony about this commotion that the witnesses heard from the bedroom. We heard that Mr. Ford left upset. We heard that Ms. Weston was upset. Mr. Ford even agreed in his testimony that he was the one who had Ms. Weston's cell phone. He was the one that made the call to Ms. Weston's mother. When asked on cross-examination, why did you use her phone to call her mother if she wanted to talk to her mom, his response was, beats the heck out of me. That's all evidence, aside from Ms. Weston's credibility, that goes to the kidnapping. And of course, the kidnapping here was defined...
How does that establish that if he uses her cell phone to call her mother, what is it factually support?
This is all circumstantial evidence. There's nothing definitive here, but it all...
It's circumstantial, but circumstantial proof of what?
It proves that she was being confined in the way that she claimed, and that the confinement was in order to stop her from reporting a sexual attack. So it corroborates what she said, her testimony about being confined. We also...
The two witnesses who were present, what did they testify to?
Well, Mr. Sherman, he testified that, you know, he'd been there the night before, that there'd been a drinking party going on. Then in the next morning he awoke, he heard, at some point he heard some commotion in a bedroom. I believe his testimony was that he and Miss Redearth were in the kitchen maybe making some breakfast. And he walked over. Mr. Ford came out of the bedroom door as he walked up. He found Miss Weston on the floor. He found her curled up. She was upset. She was crying. Mr. Ford left the property abruptly. Mr. Sherman testified that she looked like she'd been, quote, roughed up. She had red marks on her arm. Her face was swollen. She didn't have those marks the night before.
When the term commotion is used, was that explored? And it's in and of itself quite vague. It could be anything from people cheering at a sports event or someone screaming for survival.
I believe there were some follow-up questions asked to both witnesses on that question. That's where Michelle Redearth testified about how she heard a sound like a fractured soul. She claimed that she heard a cry or a scream coming from the room. I believe one of the two witnesses testified it sounded like furniture was being moved, that there was, you know, a muffled sound, one of them talked about, of some sort of distress. We also had testimony from Michelle Redearth, again, very similar to Mr. Sherman, that she was in the kitchen, they heard this sound, they went to the bedroom, they found her on the floor, crying, trembling. She said she used the word broken in a heap. Then she said that Miss Weston said to her, he did wrong, and pointed towards Mr. Ford, who was at that point leaving abruptly out of the house. Again, she testified about marks on the arms and legs that weren't there the night before. I'd also point out that there was cross-examination of both of these witnesses, and this goes to the effectiveness prong, but defense counsel explored all of this testimony, explored the timeline with both of these witnesses. There was a great discrepancy here about what time all this occurred, and the defense counsel talked a lot about that. He established that Miss Redearth hadn't seen Mr. Ford or Miss Weston before this incident in the hallway or in the bedroom that morning. Mr. Sherman, he cross-examined, nailing again down the timeline, and established that whether he could hear these sounds in the bedroom or any sounds before that. So it's not as though counsel, you know, sat on his hands and let this testimony come in without exploring it in detail. I'd also like to talk about the question that Judge Loken asked at the beginning about the evidentiary hearing. The record is replete with all of the evidence that Mr. Ford thinks that his counsel should have found and gotten in. The government didn't file a motion to strike when the 2255 was filed and attached as exhibits all of these tribal documents, all of these arrest records, affidavits from a private investigator hired by defense, and also a letter signed by someone claiming that Miss Weston had talked about kidnapping. So essentially this evidentiary hearing that's being requested has already occurred. It's in the record. It's largely in the appendix. All this information was considered by the magistrate court, discussed at length, and also discussed by the district court. So it is.
Wasn't part of the reason for rejecting the claim that some of these weren't even going to be admissible, though?
That's right. And, you know, the magistrate, the report and recommendations really does a job of going through each and every one of those. And I'll remind the court of kind of what the distinct pieces of evidence are here. There's a protection order from December 14th, 2010.
Okay. It seems to me what we don't have for the prejudice ruling is a precise handle on what Mr. Ford's post-conviction attorneys think the trial record would have looked like if all of these deficiencies had been run through and screened out for those that were inadmissible and so forth and so on. Aren't we making a prejudice ruling here? We have all of the raw facts from which the distillation would have begun, but we don't have the distilled facts of what the trial would have looked like had certain deficient performance allegations that were sustainable, mm-hmm. not occurred or not?
What we do have from the report and recommendations is the court went through all of these pieces of evidence and found that in all but a couple potential cases, it was all inadmissible because either they're misdemeanors.
But it's not inadmissible if it's just used for cross-exam.
Only if it goes to the untruthfulness of the witness, right? So.
Well, no. You've got the record. The counsel talked about the false, so-called false charges of kidnapping of children and so
right.
forth. So you've got whatever court records there are, and then you ask her in cross-exam, and you get maybe she admits it, maybe she doesn't. If she doesn't, then you go into what the.
Right.
Extrinsic evidence impeachment rules allow.
Well,
but at the end of the day, you have a at least somewhat, if not dramatically different trial record, and then you make your prejudice ruling, don't you? Isn't that the normal way to do this?
Well, I guess I may take issue with whether or not even the statement of prior kidnapping would be admissible. But I think your general question.
But isn't it true that you've alleged in the past that your children were kidnapped and, you know?
Right. I there's an assumption being made that would be admissible, and then there's.
Chief Judge Smith's question was if her credibility was entirely destroyed. What I'm wondering about the relevance of is what if it's more likely just there's some more impeaching evidence, and then we have the question, how would she have answered if it's just impeaching? Or let's suppose investigator is the counsel's ineffective if investigator Malloy didn't do all he told counsel he had done, which is what counsel's affidavit recites in some detail.
Right.
Well, okay, if Malloy's failings are not attributable to counsel under Strickland, now we've got a completely different case.
Right.
How can we do this? Well, there's no prejudice appeal ruling without that detail.
The district court talked about cast in terms of the Strickland standard, that it's not just, some potential effect. Some possibility of an effect on an outcome.
Probability.
Right. And so what's being offered here on a 2255 are just some, at best, some alternative explanations for some of the evidence.
That's ignoring the impeachment aspect.
Well.
Her past is such that no jury would have credited her with anything if they knew.
To be admissible, it must go to her truthfulness.
Assuming it's extrinsic proof.
Right.
That's ignoring the possibility that she would have blushed and been forced to admit 10, or, 20, 70, 80% of this.
I guess my point back to the beginning, Your Honor, is that the items that are discussed in the 2255 don't go to truthfulness, aside from three insufficient fund checks potentially going to truthfulness.
Okay, now give me the case that best supports the proposition that you can't win a 2255 just with better impeachment, an ineffective assistance claim.
Perhaps my point that I'm not making well is that this wasn't impeachment. Reckless driving, DUIs, misdemeanor DUIs.
But the guts of it was that if the jury had understood her character and history of untruthfulness, they never would have believed the thing she said.
I agree, but the pieces of information that are discussed in the 2255 don't deal with truthfulness.
The Gunderson thing would.
The Sunderland. That was a mutual protective order entered into by both parties. It doesn't. Right. It doesn't go to truthfulness, though. It goes to two people throwing things at one another. And I guess my point is the authority is simply Rule 609 in the sense that to be admissible, it either has to go to, it has to be, prior felonies or it has to go to Rule 608 to truthfulness.
At the end of Rule 609 kicks in after the cross-exam, doesn't it?
If it goes to truthfulness under 608. So,
yeah, but if the evil witness has admitted the truth of the impeaching facts, you never get to 609.
I think that's probably correct, but here we don't have facts that go to truthfulness that are even being alleged. We have some insufficient fund checks, I think three different ones, from about 7 years, the latest of which 7 years before the trial. In terms of potentially admissible allegations about her past records, that's the only one that the magistrate in the report and recommendation said was even questionable. So applying the Strickland standard to that, is that the sort of information that has a real chance, a substantial probability of changing the outcome?
Charges stuff clearly goes to motive, is not truthfulness.
And counsel argued to have that admitted, and counsel asked questions about it. Counsel won that argument. And
never got an answer to the...
And on cross-examination, the prosecutor asked more questions about it. And, Mr. Ford, when he testified, he did talk about how he was going to have to go to court because he was a witness. He did then on cross talk about how the charges were dismissed. They did talk about these pending tribal charges. I see that I'm out of time. Unless there's further questions, I'll take my seat.
Thank you, Mr. Coldwell. Ms. Ellis, your rebuttal?
I was out of time.
Oh, did she have any time left? Well, did you hear anything that you absolutely feel the court needs to hear?
But I will just correct one factual point, and that is that the evidence was that Mr. Ford used his own phone, and his phone records were introduced by the defense, that he used his own phone to call her mother because he found that she was in need of some assistance. So that was a misstatement of the facts. And there are many other arguments, but I will rest on my opening arguments. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ellis. The court thanks both counsel for the argument you provided to the court and the briefing which you've submitted. We will take the case under advisement.